This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Yesterday, it was revealed that the works of film legend P. Ramlee are to be honoured as National Heritage next week as part of a process to recognise his contribution to the national arts over the years.
Ayanda, mengapa bersila di atas lantai? Nak baca doa selamat?
Tidak. Tak fikir apa yang nak jadi pula.
Ayanda marah?
Tidak. Seronok.
Alhamdulillah.
Now, the Deputy Tourism and Culture Minister, Muhammad Bakhtiar Wan Sheikh, made the announcement, although full details will only be made known at a press conference on October 17th. Along with P. Ramlee's works, the iconic Penang Free School and the Kapitan Kling Mosque will also be listed as National Heritage Sites.
So, P. Ramlee was born on March 22nd, 1929 in Penang and was, of course, a prolific artist who made 60 films, composed around 250 songs, earning him the name Seniman Agong. Yep. He passed away at the young age of 44 on May 29th, 1973, and his final resting place is the Kampung Baru Muslim Cemetery in KL's Golden Triangle.
Yeah, we all know P. Ramlee. Love him for his classic films, including comedies like Labu Dan Labi, Ali Baba Bujang Lapo, Madu Tiga, and dramas Enam Jahanam and Anak Kusazali. But what rarely gets discussed is the social commentary behind the films that he made. Here's a clip from an episode of BFM's Bila Larut Malam where Daniel Kade, author of the book Membedah P. Ramlee, explains more.
Kita lihat kembali sewaktu era filem-filem P. Ramlee ini lah, waktu sekitar tahun 50-an hingga tahun 50-an, 60-an. Itu ialah waktu berlaku dikolonisasi, waktu di mana negara dalam keadaan untuk membebaskan diri dari penjajah. Jadi sikap anti penjajah itu cukup jelas dalam filem-filem P. Ramlee. Dan penjajah ini merujuk pada golongan atasan, feudal dan sebagainya. Kita dapat lihat contohnya dalam filem Pendekar Bujang Lapuk, di mana watak Ketua Samsing lakonan Mat Nisfu itu digayakan seperti seorang Inggeris. Dapat lihat dari segi pakaian, dari topi, baju dan sebagainya. Dan kita dapat juga lihat dalam filem Antara Dua Darjat, kedudukan soal feudal itu dibincangkan dengan berani, dengan lebih besar. Dan tikan yang lebih tajam kita dapat lihat dalam filem Musang Berjanggut, di mana dilihatkan di situ bahawa golongan atasan ataupun golongan pemerintah dan sebagainya dilihat sebagai golongan yang sering menggunakan kuasa tanpa ada kawalan dan sebagainya. Ini ialah satu kritikan yang sebenarnya tidak ditujukan kepada pihak-pihak yang khusus dan sebagainya, tapi ialah satu kritikan yang besar maknanya. Dan ini ialah sebagai satu tanda peringatan pada golongan-golongan yang feudal yang berkaitan.
That was Daniel Kade, who wrote a book called Membedah P. Ramlee. For the full podcast, look up Masyarakat di Mata P. Ramlee on our website or app.
So while his legacy lives on in posthumous awards and halls, museums, a road, lots of buildings named after him, prior to his death, he had actually been discredited and rejected by the entertainment industry and the public at large. And despite his previous successes, he actually died penniless.
I can't really think of P. Ramlee, unfortunately, without remembering that and actually feeling quite saddened by how things took place.
Well, I think not just, I think both the Malaysian public and the Malaysian authorities actually regret what they did to him. They never did accord him the respect he rightfully deserved when he was alive. I'm talking about academic institutions,
yes,
film scholars. There's a story that Amir Muhammad tells quite often when P. Ramlee in his later years visited, I think, a lecture at UM, and people actually booed him. It was a different time, right?
It was a different time. And I do think it's one of those things where people pass on and then you go, oh no, we've run out of time to appreciate them. And I'm not, of course, saying that this in any way takes away from the recognition. The recognition is deserved. The recognition as a national, you know, as a national treasure, national icon, that's been happening for years.
Yes.
Now being recognized as national heritage, it's very cool. I am wondering, though, what this actually means for his estate or for, you know, his family. I don't know whether this accords anything or how it applies for intangible heritage.
As far as I can tell, it means absolutely nothing. In the past, we've had these proclamations made, and I don't believe there is, I mean, unless you are a class A or like the highest class of national heritage site, then the government, I think, is obliged to do whatever it takes to protect the way you look and the status and all of that stuff, right? But I don't know if there's anything in the act that talks about funding to, say, preserve his films forever or make sure they get digitally restored.
Remastered,
all of this stuff,
yes.
Remastered, like what, everything that would go with being accorded such a status. I'm hoping with the announcement on October 17th, we will see, you know, more tangible news about this intangible national heritage, right?
Because sometimes buildings get prettied up. Sometimes they, you know, they might get a boost of recognition.
Correct.
And then that leads to funding. In a situation like this, cool though it is, I don't know exactly what real life repercussions it's going to have. I mean, regardless, it's a good reminder to go check out P. Ramlee's works. And hopefully we'll find out more next week.
We will, but there's a sad, sad addition to that, and that it's very difficult to actually watch P. Ramlee's works. They get screened from time to time on RTM and Astro, but of course, you can find full versions on YouTube. But you want legal HD copies? I don't know where you go for that.
Maybe that's a good idea for a film festival.
There
anyway,
you go.
In our next story, it turns out that humans can recognize an astonishing number of faces, 5,000 faces. And that's according to a study by scientists at Britain's University of York.
I've just seen a face, I can't forget the time or place where we just met. She's just a girl for me and I want all the world to see we've met.
So, all through most of history, humans have lived in small groups of 100 or so individuals, and that's a pattern that's, of course, changed drastically in recent centuries. And it turns out that our facial recognition abilities have had to change as well,
yep.
And they now allow us to process the thousands of faces we encounter in busy social environments, on our smartphones and our television screens every day.
Yeah, so for this study, participants were asked to write down as many faces they could remember from their personal lives and then asked to do the same with people they recognized but did not know personally. They were also shown thousands of images of famous people, two photos of each to ensure consistency, and asked which ones they recognized. The team found an enormous range of the number of faces each participant could recall, roughly from 1,000 to 10,000.
Do you think you know 10,000 faces?
I think I probably do. I mean, when you think about it, right? You think about like these famous people and celebrities. I bet you could recognize, Lynn, like actors and actresses en masse. I think world leaders, you probably immediately can point out who they are. Someone's not going to show you a photo of Mikhail Gorbachev and you're going to be like, who's that man with the birthmark
Why
on his head?
Why of all people Mikhail Gorbachev?
I don't know. My brain just went there.
I was actually thinking of P. Ramlee, that for many, many Malaysians,
right.
Perhaps even all of us, many of us, he's just one of those 5,000 faces that we would have in common, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
I mean, along with people like our leaders, of course, some of our politicians. But yeah, when it comes to icons, there are some people, Chef Wan, that I think, you know, a large amount of people would have in their bank of 5,000. So anyway, the team said it believes this figure, which is the first ever baseline of human facial vocabulary, could aid the development of facial recognition software increasingly used at airports and for criminal investigations.
Also for fish.
As brought up by Sean Tanis.
On Monday, we spoke about salmon and how we can use facial recognition technology to improve their health.
Something to do with their gills and spots.
Apparently. studies also said, the researchers also said it might be possible for some people to continue learning to recognize an unlimited number of faces given enough practice, since the brain has almost an limitless capacity to memorize words and languages. The limits on these actually instead come from study time and motivation. Here's an explainer from Slate.com that explains the math behind our brain storage.
Most computational neuroscientists estimate human storage capacity somewhere between 10 and 100 terabytes. A terabyte is 1,000,000 megabytes. The math behind these estimates is fairly simple. The human brain contains roughly 100 billion neurons. Each neuron seems capable of making around 1,000 connections, representing about 1,000 potential synapses, which largely do the work of data storage. Multiply each of these 100 billion neurons by the approximately 1,000 connections it can make, and you get 100 trillion data points, or about 100 terabytes of information. But neuroscientists are quick to admit that these calculations may be off. For one thing, we're not sure how many synapses transmit at different strengths. Some could store several bits at a time. Others might process instead of store information. We don't yet know everything about how data is stored or moved throughout the brain. And while computers are faster at completing specialized tasks, our brains are simply still much more complex than an external hard drive. And more efficient. To run a computer as complex as the brain, some estimate you'd need the same amount of power used to run all of Washington, D.C. So insults about a
The range of faces recognized by participants went far beyond what may have been evolutionarily useful. For thousands of years, humans would likely only have met a few dozen people throughout their lives. And the lead researcher said it wasn't clear why we developed this ability, commenting that this could be another case of overkill that we sometimes see in nature. Mm. And I quote, "The venom of some spiders can kill a horse, even though the spider has no need to eat a horse."
It's just there, la.
It's just there.
Do it.
So, yeah, I don't know. How many faces do you recognize? You think 5,000? It might be there.
It's an interesting study. I wish they would put it online so we can like click through and figure it out. We want to ask you as well, how many faces you recognize? Are you good at placing a face with a name? Therein lies my problem. I can remember faces. I'm very bad at names. How many faces would almost all Malaysians have in common? Like you mentioned, Chef Wan, P. Ramli, Mahathir, you know,
Siti Nohaliza.
Siti Nohaliza. We're all, you know, these are everyday faces that we are trained to actually become familiar with, other than our families.
It's kind of freaky to me that my brain could store 5,000 faces. And yet now that I'm confronted with this reality, I think it's probably true. Moving on to our next story, it is about school holidays and overcrowding. So we don't have summer holidays,
no.
But we are, I think almost everyone is familiar with the kind of glut that happens during school holidays. I mean, if you live in some parts of the world, near a school perhaps, traffic is great. Mm-hmm. If on the other hand, you live near a tourist hub, then, you know, Godspeed. So the Tourism, Arts and Culture Ministry wants to propose staggered school holidays to grow the tourism sector and to reduce crowds at local tourist hotspots.
Yeah, so Deputy Minister Mohammad Bakhtiar Wan Chik said that they were currently working on that proposal that would only apply for shorter breaks that were the breaks that take place in March, June and September and not the long year-end school breaks, right? So essentially, the week-long school holidays could be staggered over 3 weeks during the holiday season.
The ministry believes that this staggered school holidays will give tourist spots in the country a steadier stream of domestic tourists instead of the overcrowding that happens now during school holidays. Here is an example of what tourist overcrowding can do to a city from a report from Al Jazeera.
Venice, the timeless city that tourists seem to have little time for. 20 million visit each year, three quarters of them only stay for 24 hours. They follow the same routes, see the same sights. Their impact is devastating. Fed-up residents are leaving forever, 1,000 each year. For them, house prices are astronomically high, the crowds unbearable. The Italian city no longer caters for them, they say. UNESCO is threatening to blacklist the World Heritage Site unless action is taken. A campaign to enjoy and respect Venice is underway. Police move on tourists who sit on steps and encourage them to visit less popular attractions. But there are no plans to reduce tourist numbers, only reroute them.
To try and encourage the right type of visitor, the city has also introduced fines, putting up these posters all over Venice. Tourists can be fined $240 for picnicking on a bridge like this, $120 for littering. They can also be charged for pausing too long, which many of these tourists would be guilty of, and for generally being annoying.
So that was a report from Al Jazeera, and God knows there are plenty of annoying tourists. A steadier stream of tourists would also mean tourism players won't have to face a situation where income generated varies significantly between seasons, or what the Deputy Minister calls a feast or famine situation.
Staggered breaks are not new. People in Kedah, Johor, Kelantan and Terengganu have their weekend breaks on Fridays and Saturdays.
Correct.
And the details for this proposal are still in the works. The ministry is still getting more data, such as hotel occupancy rates during school holidays.
So, I am of two minds of this actually taking place, because it sounds like an interesting proposal. However, it doesn't sound like something that's going to be easily implemented given teacher workloads and how all of that works as well. I think maybe if you do it on a state-to-state basis, as opposed to like a regional basis, as opposed to a school-to-school thing. I don't know. I don't know how you would go about it. It seems like a logistical nightmare implementing something like this, right?
We would love to hear from you, though. I mean, how do you feel about staggering school holidays? Do you think that would make it easier or more difficult to plan holidays for you and your family?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's another part of this proposal about public holidays as well. They're trying to adopt maybe what the US and the UK do a lot of the time, where they take school holidays and they actually put it on a... they combine 9 public holidays and throw it on a Monday.
Yes.
So, you know, just because Vesak Day may be a Wednesday, it doesn't mean the public holidays on Wednesday. It'll be the following Monday, so you get a long weekend and they just call it the bank holiday weekend, right? And we want to know if you'd be happier with that as well, or do you like those occasional midweek breaks?
So, staggering school holidays, placing bank holidays in placement of our random midweek holidays. What do you think? We want to hear your thoughts in the middle of the work week. We're talking about holidays, but still, 7733 2900 is that number to call. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. Right now, some music. Feist.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my, BFM 89.9, the business station.